coming up.
The mission of the university is the creation, preservation, and proliferation of knowledge for the benefit of all.
The idea of the university.
A fool's brain digests philosophy into folly, science into superstition, and art into pedantry. Hence, university education.
It is the one and only way that we can transfer the knowledge of civilization to the next generation, and if we don't do that, civilization will be diminished.
Aren't the essentials of a great university just football for the alums, parking for the faculty, and romance for the students?
I will hold to the mission of the university that I described.
Our guest, John Etchemendy, Provost of Stanford University.
As you can tell, I think universities are great institutions. If you want a provost who can argue with the dean of the law school, who are you going to pick? Well, a philosopher.
The idea of the university, coming up on Philosophy Talk after the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today, we're recording the program in front of a live audience here at the Annenberg Auditorium on the Stanford campus.
Our thinking originates just a stone's throw away at Philosopher's Corner.
Today's program is part of the Classes Without Quizzes series during Stanford's reunion homecoming week. Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk.
Our topic today is the idea of a university.
Well, John, as philosophers, we both know a lot about ideas. That's our stock and trade. And we've both spent our entire working lives in the university, so it follows, ergo, we know everything there is to know about the idea of a university, right?
Plausible inference, big fella. But in my case, it's wrong. I mean, I'm really happy that universities exist. I'm even happier that they support philosophy departments and seem to think that I do something useful. But the longer I have spent in universities and the more I become familiar with the vast differences among schools and departments and the different expectations of all the people involved in the universities, how differently things are done in universities elsewhere, particularly in different lands, frankly, I'm pretty confused. I don't have much of a feel what is the essence of a university? What are they supposed to be? I have heard a good explanation of what the provost and the president mainly do, however.
And I'll say, what would that be? That's a good one. What would that be?
Well, rumor has it the most pressing issues are football for the alumni, parking for the faculty, and how should I put this? Providing an active social life for the undergraduates.
Well, you know, I'd give Stanford, an A minus maybe these days for football, B minus for parking, and that third one, I'm not too up on that. But let's get back to your confusions and puzzlement. What puzzles you really about the university?
Well, let's start with research and teaching. We charge our undergraduates a lot of money. We draw the best students from around the world to be our undergraduates, or at least they're as good as any others at Harvard or anyplace else. But all these schools, Stanford, Harvard, the University of Oregon, the University of California, all the elite universities, we all know at those places that it's research that's the main criterion for hiring and promotion. So what is a university? A teaching institution or a big research lab with some students around the edges to bring in tuition?
John, that's a false dichotomy. I think it's a both and. I mean, we can walk and chew gum. We can research and teach, so why not? It seems to work.
You sound like a pragmatist, but isn't there something about the idea of university that you're a little puzzled about?
Well, there's actually a lot about the idea of university I'm puzzled about. You know, before I was chair, I used to think of the university as a place where people like you and me can do their thing. You know, you gather a lot of smart people around, let them think and write and teach, and that's basically what we do. And we think and write and teach what we want to do. That's what the university's for. But, you know, then I became chair. I spent 6 years doing that, and you get a broader perspective. You see, there are all these competing forces on this institution and any institution like it. All these departments compete for resources, programs want to grow here and grow there, and it's not just internal competition. There's all these pressures from outside the university for the university to serve the country or whatever. So there's all this massive stuff, and it's just a sprawling, complicated enterprise, you know. It's very far from Plato's Academy, where just smart people thought and wrote and taught.
It is amazing. I was chairman too, and you go around the university and you find that you want to do something perfectly reasonable, like hire another Descartes scholar, and there's all these people all these people that think that curing cancer or training another generation of lawyers or you know, something like that is more important. It's really baffling. But you've done very well at getting us resources. But, what's your problem?
Well, just what you just said. Think, you know, my reflective moments, I think, what is this place for? Who does it serve? Who owns this place? I mean, you know, you think, well, it's a corporation and it's owned by the trustees. Ultimately, we're answerable to the trustees, right? But we're a private university, a not-for-profit university, so we're supposed to serve some higher good, right? Is it the world at large, humanity at large? Is it just the interest of our nation? Or is it, as a lot of faculty like to think, something more abstract, something more ethereal? Truth, at whatever cost. Knowledge, at whatever cost. You know, and then there's the question, who decides whether we've done it right? Is it us, the faculty? Is it the alumni? Is it the students? Is it the administration? I mean, so there are lots of questions.
So traditionally, universities, whatever else they are a place. Universities are a place where books and faculty and labs and students and deans can all come together and reap the benefits of being together. But now there are internet universities. Are they the wave of the future? Will Stanford just be a dinosaur in the great new world of distributed universities, whose libraries and classrooms are just URLs on the internet?
You know, I think that's a really fascinating question, Johnny. You know, we really do have a lot to talk about. Luckily, we've got just the fellow to help us. That's Stanford's provost, John Etchemendy, the philosophy department's very own former chair and colleague. He'll join us in a moment.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Corneli, takes a deeper look at the idea of an internet-based university. She files this report.
If you've spent any time on the internet, you've probably seen advertisements for the University of Phoenix. The school was founded more than 30 years ago. Its website says it's the largest private accredited university in the country, with more than 300,000 students, many of whom take courses online.
It's a real sense of accomplishment when you see that you can make a big difference in someone's lives and help them break through a glass ceiling that was there. That's very exciting to me.
Douglas Threet is area chair for management and finance at the school's offices in San Jose, California.
Basically, we are a university that serves folks that have, in many cases, dropped out of high school. Now they're out there working. They've got a family. They've got a mortgage. And they know that there's a glass ceiling because they don't have their collegiate degree.
Threet says for many young people, a traditional college education is not an option.
Some of our districts have 25% of the students that don't complete their high school diplomas. Some districts have as high as 40. That's a great segment of our population that needs training. They want to be better citizens. And all of those things, I think, a university can meet those needs.
The University of Phoenix steps in to serve that population.
25% of our graduates, for example, are African American, well above the other institutions in the United States. The same is with the Hispanic population as well. I had a student in one of the courses, a young, single, African-American mother. Candidly, she couldn't write her way out of a wet paper bag. And she came to me and she said, "What am I going to do? I need to learn how to write." I said, "Yes, you do. Let's get you into the writing lab. Let's work on this. You can improve. You've got the first requirement. You've got a GA. You got a great attitude." And so we started working with her, and by the time she graduated, she could write that page and a half memo to a senior manager in this situation and do a very good job. It was a great experience just to work with her and see her growth and her development.
Threet says Phoenix and other online programs expand the idea of a university beyond the traditional research versus teaching debate.
I think the truth probably is that the definition of a university is a little broader than we may at first conceive, that there's room for everybody. There's a research purpose, there's a learning purpose, there's a teaching purpose, there's a practitioner model. That's the model we use at the University of Phoenix.
That means the focus is on acquiring practical knowledge with career applications. No need for a campus.
It's a distributed education model. So it means it's a model that is available, has great access to those who are unable, for one reason or another, to attend what we would call an on-ground campus situation. And in this age of internet, folks want that kind of program, and as a result, it's meeting a real need.
Threet says he likes to think of universities as lighthouses.
Each one of them helps its particular flotilla of ships find a safe harbor, find the safety that they need to progress and go forward. But I think at the end of the day, the university is to build lives, strengthen people so that they can be better citizens in our country, and at the same time, better themselves professionally with their families as well.
And that, he says, is something that can happen on the internet just as well as on the ground. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Zoe Corneli.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Annenberg Auditorium at Stanford University. I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor.
And we're joined now by John Etchemendy. He's a prolific philosopher, an award-winning teacher, and now he's provost of this fine university. John, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, Ken.
John, I'm going to call you Edge so that people don't get confused between you and I who are listening on the radio. We don't look that much alike. But. So, Edge, let me start with a personal question. You're a philosopher, indeed a logician. Not really very practical training. Philosophers and logicians are noted for occupying the highest parts of the ivory tower. The image of a philosopher is Thales, the ancient philosopher who fell in a well while thinking deep thoughts. Did philosophy help you? Did it prepare you to be provost? Or are you such a great provost in spite of philosophy?
First of all, I learned philosophy at the foot of the master, John Perry. I think that philosophy is probably the best training that you can get for general purpose analysis, reasoning, logic, analytical reasoning, clear communication, and so forth. So yes, I use my skills as a philosopher, such as they are, every day. I mean, if you want a provost who can argue with the dean of the law school, who are you going to pick? Well, a philosopher.
All right. So we want you to be a philosopher again now, and tell us not about the university, but about the idea of a university. How do you conceive of a university? What's your analysis? Just a big research institute that admits students and puts on football games to keep the alumni happy and the tuition rolling in? Or is there some more honorable and coherent conception?
Well, coherent, isn't it perfectly obvious, John? No, seriously. What I say is the mission of Stanford University, and I actually think if you look at mission statements of any of universities that have such things, you'll find that they're all very similar. But the mission of the university is the creation, preservation, and proliferation of knowledge, or transmission of knowledge, for the benefit of all. Now, that basically pulls in everything that we do. The creation of knowledge, that is the research, right? Preservation of knowledge. Well, preservation of knowledge, of course, is in part the libraries and museums and so forth and so on that we have, but much more important is transferring that knowledge to the next generation. And the transmission of knowledge is the education function.
That all sounds very good, you know, but it doesn't have much bite yet because there's lots of knowledge out there that we could create, preserve, and transmit. Then we have to make hard choices about which knowledge, right, to whom. I mean, how does the mission statement of the university drill down and help us understand which knowledge we're supposed to be trying to create, knowledge where, about what, right, and then transmit to whom? How do we decide those questions?
No, absolutely not. I mean, it's which knowledge, any knowledge. I mean, knowledge is very broad, and the university is very broad. And one of the things about a university is that universities, if they're not going to die, grow. And the reason they grow is because the fields of knowledge expand. I mean, as we know more, a university has to expand. So, no, I wouldn't want to say you choose a subset of the areas.
Well, so if we went back, you know, the university is a really old thing, right? It goes way back. I mean, Plato's Academy, the medieval university, universities in the 19th century, the German university, it's a very old thing. I mean, and the branches of knowledge wither and die and grow. And what is the university's role in sort of helping that or making that happen? I mean, do we just do that ourselves?
In other words, can you give us some really good reason to have a philosophy department? Yeah,
philosophy is the queen of the sciences, you know that.
Or any given department. What justifies the inclusion of it?
I actually think that the departments come and less frequently go. So if you looked at the history of human knowledge, there are, as areas become more clearly understood, they become disciplines of their own. So psychology came out of philosophy about 150 years ago. Computer science came out of philosophy about 50 years ago. Physics came out of philosophy about 1,000 years ago, and so forth and so on. Yeah. But new disciplines appear, new departments appear. Do departments go away? Sometimes they do, and sometimes they do prematurely. Many universities got rid of geography departments about 50 years ago, and actually the field of geography has actually had a resurgence thanks to geographical information systems, and so they probably think that we should have kept that geography department.
This is a special edition of Philosophy Talk, recorded live at Stanford's Reunion Homecoming Week. Our guest is Provost John Etchemendy.
We've been talking about what a university is, the very idea of a university. We're going to continue with that topic by asking just what the mission of a university is, and in the light of that, who owns the university? Our live audience is mostly Stanford alumni. As you look back on your experiences, what was most valuable? What was least valuable? You don't need to mention my name, by the way. About your experience here at Stanford.
Whose university is it and who does it serve? Along with questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. It's all right now. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, and we're discussing the very idea of a university. Our guest is John Etchemendy, the provost of Stanford.
What is the mission of a university, and to whom does it answer? The students, the trustees, all of society, which society? America, the whole world, the world of people, or the world of knowledge and truth in the abstract?
John, I was an undergraduate at Notre Dame, and I read Cardinal John Henry Newman's idea of a university. He thought of the university as in service of the divine, as helping us get knowledge of truth and beauty, ultimately in connection to the divine. Okay, but let's think. Who does a secular university like Stanford serve? Does it serve its faculty? Does it serve its students? Does it serve society at large? Does it serve the Board of Trustees? Who do we serve? To whom do we answer?
I think the answer is simple. Society. Society, or at risk of sounding sort of overblown, civilization. I think that is the clear answer. And it serves students, it serves faculty, the service of the university is to
How exactly does that work? I mean, you could serve society. I mean, society has like concrete needs. We're not going to balance the budget. We're not going to. Some of our colleagues may discover a cure for cancer. But you know, society at large doesn't care about me sitting in my office writing the great works of philosophy. Right? I hope. You know, I know you guys do. But society at large, they say, Ken Taylor writing philosophy. What social good is that? Because we don't solve the concrete day-to-day problems.
No. Well, I actually think that's not quite true, Ken. We serve society by advancing knowledge. The knowledge eventually becomes applied, sometimes very quickly, sometimes less quickly, that can be in the form of developing an MRI machine. The universities developed the technology that led to MRI machines, microwaves, et cetera, et cetera. And that eventually becomes in service to our lives, right? And it becomes in service to the country. It's in service to the economy of the country. It's also in service to individuals' lives. Obviously, medical research. How about the education? The education, it is in the interest of our society that we have an educated populace. It is the one and only way that we can transfer the knowledge of civilization to the next generation, and if we don't do that, that knowledge will go away and civilization will be diminished.
Well, this is all very noble sounding, but in the day-to-day decisions that are made around the university, to what sense, in what sense does this percolate down? Take students, undergraduate students. I think we have 6,500 undergraduates at any one time. Who do we pick? Do we pick the group of undergraduates by admitting which we will most benefit civilization or society? Or do we pick the ones that will be most fun to have in our classroom and maybe make the most giving alumni? I mean, why don't we admit students, you know, have a cutoff, say if you're this bright, then we admit you by lottery. How does it really help civilization that we go out and get the ones who spend all our time being cheerleaders? I mean, I have a personal stake here. I didn't get my act together in high school. Why don't we get the students who didn't get their act together in high school so we could do more for them while they're at Stanford?
Well, I think, you know, it's often said, and it's true, that United States has the best system of higher education in the world. And the reason for that is not because it has Harvard and Stanford and these other great institutions at the top. The reason for that is the incredible variety of universities and colleges that we have, and they serve different populations. We just heard from an individual from the University of Phoenix, a wonderful institution that provides a service to individuals that would not be getting education if they didn't have the online access to an online form of education. It's like an ecological niche with different universities, different colleges, serving different populations, and that is crucial to the strength of our society.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the very idea of the university with Provost John Acciamini. In whose interest does the university work? Who does it serve? Who owns it? Who are the stakeholders? We're in front of a live audience here in Annenberg Auditorium in Stanford University. We've got a question from that live audience now. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir. Tell us your name and maybe your class year or something.
Hubert Morel, C2, class of 1962. I'd like to address 3 points, and before I might forget, given my age. So I want to talk about your program, University of Phoenix, and ultimately the purpose of a university. When it comes to your program, it reminds me of Car Talk. A lot of fun and not that much substance, except for a few gems here and there. When it comes to University of Phoenix, it sounds to me like an advanced vocational school. And when it comes to purpose of university, you mentioned a lot the words knowledge, but you have not even once mentioned the word wisdom. I would have thought the purpose of university is not simply the transmission and acquisition of knowledge, but also the acquisition of wisdom on the participants. And I think to a large degree, when it's mentioning the fact that you are looking to address the world as a whole, and with so much support from the military-industrial complex, I have some reservations. But my main question to you is the question of transmission or acquisition of wisdom, and to a large degree I want to congratulate you, because I believe that the Department of Philosophy is probably the one closest to that goal.
Well, thank you very much. Well, you say you're graduated in 62, and I think the word wisdom probably has decreased a lot in its use since then. Nowadays, it has a slightly elitist sound, and we don't like elitism. Even at elite university, where we pick the elite students and we pick the elite faculty, then if one of them gets up and says, well, you know, I not only know a lot, but I'm wise. Once you have gray hair, you can get away with it, but before that, it's pretty dangerous. But I agree with you. I think there is such a thing as wisdom, and if you can't find it at a university, where are you going to find it? What do you think, Etch?
I it's a really good point. The way I think about it is, the reason I chose knowledge rather than wisdom in that statement is that I believe that there is a big difference, and knowledge alone is not sufficient for wisdom, but what is required is experience. So knowledge plus experience can lead to wisdom. And so I think we do a very good job educating our undergraduates and our graduate students, but do I think that they come out wise, that when they were done, they are wise? I wouldn't use that term.
Well,
I actually would not use that term. I would hope that they have the knowledge and the basis to become wise, but they require more experience in life.
But I agree with you, Etch, and I think the questioner has a kind of deep challenge, although the stuff about the program I reject, and we can argue about that. But look, I do think that if knowledge is just technical knowledge, even if knowledge is just scientific knowledge, I agree that's not enough. Right? All the technology, all the science in the world will not tell us how to live in, as human beings in a world together, will not tell us what we ought to do with this planet, to this planet, for one another. I mean, we have to rethink human life and human culture. But I do think the university is in the business of re-narrating human life, re-narrating human culture, and that's not the science's job so much to do that, but that's why we have the humanities in the university, to reimagine human possibilities in the light of all the technological advances we make and all the scientific knowledge we acquire. But we've got a lot more questions.
I want to add one more thing here, though, regarding wisdom and your very interesting question. We don't choose our students on the basis of wisdom, and we don't choose our faculty on the basis of wisdom, but I think our students choose our faculty often on the basis of wisdom. A faculty member that gives a particularly thoughtful course and actually addresses students' concerns about the value of life and where it's all going, that kind of person gets a good audience here. So I think wisdom does, in this unpredictable way, still play an important role in the university.
We've got more questions from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, man.
Thank you, Linda Clever, undergraduate and medical school at Stanford. I'd just like to say I listen to both Car Talk and Philosophy Talk. My car works very well, and so does my mind. And so I was wondering, in the midst of all of this important discussion, if you could talk about sports and where sports fit into the mind and body and soul. Thank you.
I'm gonna say something first, to provoke you. I think when universities got into big time sports entertainment, it was a mistake of the highest order, and I'm not talking about Stanford in particular, but it prostituted and corrupted the university, and it's completely inconsistent with what we ought to be doing. We ought not to be fielding quasi-professional sports teams.
Tell me what you really feel, Ken. So, where does sports fit in? In fact, to be honest, sports is not essential to a university, and particularly intercollegiate sports. There are universities, for example, in Europe, it is not the case that intercollegiate athletics happens as a part of what the university does. The way I see it is, so I will hold to the mission of the university that I described. Now, there are certain things that we do that do not follow from that mission, but they're ancillary to that mission, and there's a good reason why they occur at the university. We do clinical work, we have a hospital, we serve patients. That's not part of what the university needs to do, but if you are going to be teaching medical students, if you're going to be doing medical research, then it is important to have patients and to provide
I'm
clinical
trying to get you from there
now,
to the sports.
Sports, sports, exactly. So one of the things we do is teach undergraduates, and we take them at a particular period in their lives, and I believe that there is more to life than the life of the mind. I'm sorry to say that, but and it is an important part of the development of an individual, particularly, well, throughout their life, but particularly through that period. That's why it's traditionally been the case that there has been sports at a university. Now, the intercollegiate nature of sports, and particularly the entertainment side of that, has been a fairly recent development. And I can't say I completely disagree with some of what you said, though I would never say it quite.
Of course, I'm sure you couldn't.
But I think you make a very valid point. If we didn't have a football team, could we really have an active sports medicine program?
Right. Another question from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talks here.
Tell us
your name and your class.
Jim Tupin, class of 73. I have two questions about the economic nature of the institution. One is about the fact that some knowledge has greater current economic value than other knowledge and can attract funding to the university. How does that affect the university as a knowledge transmission institution? And the second question is, do you, as you look at the service you're providing your students, that is to say the education they're receiving, evaluate that on any criterion other than they're still willing to pay the tuition?
So the first question about funding, and funding comes in more easily or more quickly or more generously for certain disciplines, certain departments, and certain areas. That's true, and the university resists allowing expansion simply driven by funding. That we don't do that. As a matter of fact, we have a system for fixing the number of faculty that can be hired in a given area independent of how much funding that area may have. We call it a billeting system. And so we try to determine the number of faculty by the needs of the discipline itself and by the needs of the students.
Well, John Etch,
yeah.
A lot of our colleagues would think that this gentleman is onto something, because I mean, in the university, the humanities, for example, feel constantly beleaguered. Now, I don't know if it's justified that we feel constantly beleaguered, but we feel constantly beleaguered. And we feel like, you know, the professional schools, the sciences, the applied research, everybody wants that to happen. But people don't understand this thing I said about the humanities, that we're there for re-envisioning human possibilities, the human formations, right? Re-narrating the world. And I don't know, it's why do you think humanists feel beleaguered in all universities? Good. I mean, his remark would explain.
It's the nature of humanists to feel beleaguered. How's that?
Because we're paranoid wussies. Yeah.
But I do want to say one other thing about the funding of the university, and particularly you mentioned tuition. I mean, it's interesting that Stanford's funding comes from really three sources, and they're roughly equal. One is research funding that comes largely from the federal government. One is tuition and other income, if you will, from services rendered, including clinical services and so forth and so on. And one is gifts, past and present, so endowment income and current gifts and so forth and so on. But roughly equal amounts. And neither the tuition that a student pays, even if the student is paying full tuition, does not cover the full cost of their education, nor, in fact, does the research funding from the government cover the whole cost of the research. Now, how is that possible? Well, it's possible because it's filled in by that third source, and that's absolutely crucial. Now, that's true of a private university. That's how the funding for a private university works. If you go to a public university, it's very, very similar, except instead of the endowment, what you have is tax revenue, that you have the state general fund flowing into, say, the University of California, and that's what fills in that third piece.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our guest is John Etchemendy, Provost at Stanford University.
We're coming to you from the Annenberg Auditorium on a Stanford campus. We've been discussing the idea and the mission of the university and to whom they are responsible and who's in charge. Traditionally, universities have been geographical places where scholars, students, labs, and books can all come together. Coming up next, we're going to ask, where do such universities fit into the world of the 21st century, where important places may not be geographical, but cybergraphical?
Universities in cyberspace, along with more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to the Annenberg Auditorium at Stanford University. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing the very idea of the university with Provost John Etchemendy. We've got more questions from our live audience here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Yeah, Scott Silvera, class of 1983. I ran into one of our coordinators for the class of 1983 who had asked me to do something, and I put him off. I never did do it. I felt bad. I asked him what it was. He asked me to call 10 people in my class and ask for donations. And I sat here thinking, you know, we have a $17 billion endowment. And I learned a bit earlier from one of your tour guides that for the first 30 years of this school's existence, students paid no tuition at all. The Leland and Jane Stanford Endowment paid for that. I guess the question I would ask you is, If a corporate structure didn't feel like the philosophy department were important at all, how long would you exist? I mean, let's say if Harvard, who has a larger endowment than Stanford does, decided to get rid of its philosophy department, how much longer would this department exist?
I want to ask, do we still have $17 billion?
probably not, actually. Let me say something about that, because I think one of the things, there's a misconception about universities and what universities are that leads to questions like, well, you know, doesn't Harvard have enough? Doesn't Stanford have enough? The answer to the first is yes. The answer to the second is no. seriously. But look, think of what I said the mission of the university was. It is to serve society, to address major problems, to conduct research that solves problems in the world. Take, for example, what the Gates Foundation does. Gates Foundation is very large, has lots and lots of money, much more money than Stanford, something like $30, $50 billion. I'm not sure what it is. But they're tackling huge, huge problems. They're tackling problems of human health. They're tackling problems of K-12 education. And nobody says they have too much money. Why? Well, because the problems they're tackling are really big and they don't have enough money to solve those problems. In fact, Warren Buffett decided to take his money and not start a foundation, give it to the Gates Foundation. Now, there's not a single person who said, Warren, why are you doing that? What a stupid thing to do. They have enough money. They don't have enough money to do all the things, provide all the service that they're trying to provide. Universities are the same way.
Can I spin our mission slightly differently? I don't know if it helps untie this knot or not. I think you're basically right, but I would describe what we do as generating and accumulating intellectual capital, and then exploiting that capital for the good of society. And sometimes the accumulation of intellectual capital is long term, long horizon, right? And sometimes you started trying to accumulate capital, you don't know if it's ever going to pay off, but you let the mind go and try to generate intellectual capital. And that's what we're about. And sometimes society looking at us is like, where are the goods? Where are the goods? Where's the deliverables? But sometimes we're not going to deliver for centuries, you know? I mean, sometimes we're not going to deliver for decades. But still, we should be able to we need a place in our society that's devoted to the no-holds-barred accumulation of intellectual capital.
Ken, I think that's right, but I think that really undervalues the university, and we do deliver. There is not a major advance, a major technological advance, a major scientific advance that did not have its source, or there are very, very few, that did not have their source at universities.
I agree. I agree we do deliver, but I don't think that everything we do at every moment is producing a deliverable.
No, I agree with that.
We've got more questions on this side of the room.
Wally Honeywell, class of 58. 50 years ago, when I graduated, somehow I was instilled with a love of learning, and I was inspired by many professors at various times. It sounded then, and it still sounds, like the university doesn't know why. That the accumulated value of our undergraduate students' intellectual wisdom is not clearly defined. Could you address that, please?
Well, I'll say that about 1985, after being here about 15 years, I went into became a resident fellow in Wilbur Hall when my kids went to college to earn a little extra money, rented out our house. And that gave me a whole side of undergraduate education I'd never seen before. I taught undergraduates, taught lots of introductory courses, but there was a whole side of the university that I didn't understand. I didn't understand what the students did when they came home. And I think the whole university is kind of that way. It's a good example of what Friedrich Hayek calls not a top-down organization, but a kind of a spontaneous organism that somehow works. The university somehow works, and I would say even having these athletic teams somehow seems to be part of the mix. And you can look at the top down and say, I don't quite see why it works, and maybe it'd work better like this. But you have to be a little bit conservative and be a little bit careful. Over the course of watching freshmen come in 4 years, later graduate and you see these remarkable changes and these wonderful people graduating, and you realize the way they got from here to there was not what you would have predicted and not what you would have planned. So in a way, leave well enough alone, that's Provost.
We've got time for one last question from our live studio audience.
Hi, Randy Silvers from class of 88. And when I finished here, Alan Bloom, a classics professor at University of Chicago, wrote Closing of the American Mind. And one of the missions which you've alluded to is serving society. One of Bloom's theses was that the university was a very aristocratic institution and should act as a clarion call if it sees something wrong in society. Tenure is one of those practices that protects university professors to basically say what their minds think. What would you think that Bloom would say, or what would you say about that, particularly in the aftermath of September 11th? I was in the United States for a year, and then I lived abroad. And what I saw was a tyranny of the majority, and what I heard was deafening silence from universities, from professors who were not doing a good job of questioning. Maybe the media were shouting them out and shutting them out, but has tenure, is there some other institution we need so that this doesn't happen again? Or am I wrong and universities were fulfilling their mission in serving society in this regard?
Well, I think that's a really complicated question, because I don't think the university as such either criticizes or not criticizes. I think faculty members and students, individual voices, but Stanford as a corporate entity, it's in a complicated relationship with society. But individual faculty, we do have the freedom, but some people will use the freedom some way and some people will use the freedom other way. There is, I think, on university campuses, profound social analysis taking place in many places. But there are also people who don't partake in that profound social analysis.
I actually think that you will find, so even post 9/11, you will find university faculty who have expressed every possible view, some of them very objectionable views in the minds of most people, but every possible view rational view that can be held about the issues of the day, and have expressed that as well and written that as well. So I don't see that universities have fallen short on that.
I'm pretty sympathetic, though, with what our questioner says. I mean, in America, we have these great freedoms. There's the freedom of the press. There's, with the tenure system, there's freedom, at least for tenured professors, to say what they want without being fear of being fired. And I think post 9/11, although lots of particular individuals did stand up and say this is, you know, bull dinghy, or this is so forth and so on, by and large, you meet very few professors that owe their jobs to not being fired because they had tenure and said something outrageous. I think the media was a great failure, too. So I think we do need something more. I wish I knew what it was.
I agree, but I want to speak up for university life and philosophy and the discourse that takes place in university campuses all the time, because I am deeply distressed by the state of public discourse in America. I think it's vapid and empty often. I think the media, I think the political class mostly doesn't engage in sort of rational persuasion, but in manipulation, right? On the university campus, alone among the citizens of places in our society, there is passionate but still rational discourse where people take ideas seriously and they take arguments seriously. I mean, you sit in a university meeting and people are deeply engaged and committed to their points of views, but they argue reasonably. And that's one of the things we owe to our students, to model that and inculcate that. And I think we do a darn good job, to tell you the truth.
Our very first philosophy talk show was not too far after 9/11, and it had to do, or not too far after the invasion of Iraq. And it had to do with the whole idea of interventionism and the Bush Doctrine. It was a great show. Our guest was somebody who taught at West Point. But there's something about our culture where that kind of inquiry doesn't rise very close to the surface of the public's consciousness.
So I'll give you a chance for one last observation or comment or whatever you want to say in closing.
One last comment, I hope brief. And I think, as you can tell, I think universities are great institutions. I think that society would be truly diminished without maintaining the strength of universities. And I actually do worry that public and governmental lack of understanding of what a university really is and at the breadth of its mission threaten that.
On that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah. Thank you.
Our guest has been John Antimendi, Provost of Stanford University.
John, thanks for joining us. We also want to thank everyone in our live Homecoming Week audience for participating in the program. Give yourselves a round of applause.
So, John, what did you learn today? I mean, you've been at universities all your life. You probably understand them up, down, and... But did you learn anything?
Oh, no, I don't understand universities at all. But, you know, if they think they want to have me around, I'm not going to question
them. But do you have any new thoughts?
Well, I just had thoughts rekindled about how lucky we are to have John Antimendi as provost. And being provost, 8, 10 years, doesn't seem to have hurt his intellect very much.
Yeah.
And he looks healthier than ever. And our alumni are always always pleased to see the alumni. They're kind of, you know, not, you're kind of just sitting around bringing in the money as some tax lawyer. We got people that stand up and give us tough questions, or at least gave Antimendi tough questions.
Yeah, so, there you go. You know, my thought about I think more about this. I think Provost Antimendi said something quite profound. I don't think society, whom we serve, understands us fully, and that's a source of a lot of problems. I don't think anybody outside the university, and some people within the university, understands, for example, the humanities and their role and their significance and why we should have these things and why we should have people like philosophers and medieval biblical scholars and all this stuff. And moreover, you know, we do exist in this dynamic tension. We want to criticize and perfect and hold society to its ideals and display the nature of those ideals back to them. And we want science. But society wants from us sort of immediate deliverables. And we do sometimes deliver them, but sometimes it's a long-term thing. So I think we exist in dynamic tension with the society that we serve. But this conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blago, I think, therefore I blog.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. For the final word on universities, we turn to the always scholarly Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, there is concern that universities are irreversibly shifting from a traditional role as guardians of knowledge to a new role as just another damn purveyor of information. Universities increasingly take money from big business, which funds think tanks, research, and various research centers. And the knowledge, information generated by these activities frequently is for the benefit of corporations and not necessarily the public. So, here's the question. In this new challenging era, are students still swallowing goldfish, staging panty raids, hosting keg parties, and pulling all-nighters? Well, they're up to something. Back in 2006, a student named Jonathan Pappas was sitting in a room at Butler Library at Columbia University, bored. So he bought a domain name, board@butler.com, and made a web page, a post box with the instruction, post your thoughts, but keep it anonymous. Like Facebook, in its early days, it was only available to people actually physically present at the school. The thing took off. It's a kind of cross between Twitter and MySpace and quickly turned into a franchise with over 25 sites, including Berkeley, Harvard, Princeton, University of San Francisco, and Stanford. Here's a sampling from the posts. My milkshake brings all the boys to the yard. I'm cute. Anorexic hipster chicks destroy the self-esteem of girls who actually eat from time to time instead of just smoking 24/7. Should I tell him how I feel? I am a man bull, and I have a tattoo on my butt. And, of course, as usual, spam for Viagra, announcements for a hipster-free dance, and some truly mysterious entries like turtle, I touched a groundhog, and the sweater boys are coming, no one is safe. So what does Bordat tell us about campus life today? Apparently there's a lot of sex taking place in library stacks, or at least invitations to sex, and hipsters are not popular, as in this posting. She smokes parliaments and thinks she's better than everyone else, even though her and the rest of the hipsters are the same. On the other hand, I found this. I want to have sex with Virginia Woolf, which sure sounds like something only a hipster would say. As with many internet tropes, I confess I don't quite see the value of this. It's the kind of thing you used to see written in bathroom stalls, virtual graffiti, if you will. On the other hand, Jonathan Pappas has left Columbia, moved to San Mateo, and turned the Bordat brand into an actual business, offering Bordat work franchises to business. According to Mashable.com, quote, Bordat will expand to Apple, Google, Microsoft, and Yahoo as part of its corporate beta program, unquote. So yeah, this thing could be the next Facebook. Jonathan Pappas could be the next web-based demigod, which means he could make a lot of money, which means if he's a cool guy, he might give some of that money back to Columbia University, which after all spawned the idea. What would he endow, though? A chair? A stadium? Personally, I think he should endow some bathroom stalls and throw in some magic markers. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2008.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks to Maylin Gonzalez, Linda Weigand, Leslie Vinnick, and Howard Wolf. Also thanks to Dan Brandon, Zoe Corneli, Merle Kessler, and Corey Goldman.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Daniel Elstein is our director of research, and Leo Weiss is our webmaster.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and from Powell's City of Books. Support also comes from the Templeton Foundation.
And from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.